up at the start of the end of the world, but it's feeling just like every other morning before. Now I wonder what my life is gonna mean if it's gone. The cars are moving like a half a mile an hour, and I started staring at the passengers waving goodbye. Can you tell me what was ever really special about me all this time? But I believe the world is burning to the ground. Oh well, I guess we're gonna find out. Let's see how far we've come. Let's see how far we've come. Well, I believe it all is coming to an end. Oh well, I guess we're gonna pretend. Let's see how far we've come. Let's see how far we've come.
You know, all I do all week is just listen to apocalyptic music. And then just, that's all I do. Every hour I spend working is just listening to music and then deciding which one I'm going to play to get us started. I think next week might be Johnny Cash, so we'll see. Is there any song you do not know, Adam? Good grief. Every week you've called it right. So we're in week two of this strange, surprising, hopefully delightful, but a little bit terrifying journey into the book of Revelation, not just for the point of studying a book of the Bible, but for the point instead of actually getting to know Jesus more. Word Revelation, apocalypto in Greek, it literally does not mean, apocalypse doesn't mean the end of the world. It means the revealing. And so the book of Revelation is the revealing. And what's it the revealing of? The revealing of Jesus. And so it's not a revealing of a bunch of images, not primarily. It's not a revealing of judgment, not primarily. It's a revealing of Jesus. And when we start to understand that that's what it says explicitly in the scriptures, then we begin to look at things through that lens and we begin to have our eyes open. So last week, we looked at the surprising reality that contrary to maybe a quick glimpse at Revelation, the cosmic Jesus is the same as the crucified Jesus. It's the shock when John expects to see that only one can open this scroll that's sealed. And the scroll is about the unveiling of reality in a new way and how God will one day make all things right. And nobody can open it except the Lion of Judah. And he turns around, John, looking for this lion. And what he sees is an image of a lamb that has been slain. So you heard a lot of this imagery of lambs being slain, which if you don't know much about Christian faith, I really shy away from that because it can really turn people off and say, I don't even understand, what's this all this talk about lamb? But we're leaning into it this week because it is a radical representation of the fact that God's idea of rescuing the world was not temporary in Jesus' willingness to die. What it was instead is the permanent character of a God who is self-giving, ever-suffering, always loving for the sake of redeeming one's enemies. And therefore, what we saw last week is that when we see that, we see images of Jesus as a conqueror, but we know that he conquers in the way of the Lamb, and so the sword that Jesus wields in the book of Revelation comes out of his mouth. It is his words. It is the power of Jesus' words to cut through evil and to restore what is broken in the world. And the Lamb's army then fight in the same way, not with the weapons of the world, but instead with the weapons that the scriptures talk about. Weapons of faithfulness, of love, of prayer, of suffering, of giving one's life. So that's the precursor, okay? So that's kind of what we talked about. The method of God on earth was not temporary. It was permanent. It's the method of God forever because it is the character of God. All right, have you ever had one of those moments where you have to choose a priority and you just know that it can't be both things? Often if you're early in a marriage, this can come up, where your parents, if you're closely connected to them, say, hey, you're coming over on Sunday for family dinner, right? And just a few days ago, your new spouse, has said, hey, we just need some time on Sunday afternoon together, don't we? And you said, yeah, absolutely. And all of a sudden, you're caught between two things, and you know you've got to choose. You can't do both. You have to make a priority choice. And it's hard because you know that there's going to be implications to either one. Some of you have experienced this, not in family, but maybe loving a sports team. A few of you made it quite known to me last week that you were here, even though you knew the women's game was happening at 11 o'clock. And I applaud you for that. I applaud you. And then I rewarded you by speaking really long and like you missed the entire game. So I also apologize as I applaud you. Anyways, we have these moments where we have to make choices, and we know that that's really what life is. Life is nothing if not a series of little choices that determine and reveal what matters to us, yeah? This is literally what life is. There is no future, there is no past. There is only a constant flow of present where we are faced with little choices, and every single time we make one of those little choices, it reveals what our priorities are. It reveals who we are. Sometimes it doesn't reveal who we want to be, but maybe who we are at that moment. So sometimes it's a little bit uncomfortable. And sometimes it feels like a real battle to keep what's important at the forefront. And sometimes we don't realize that our priorities have gotten out of whack. We all of a sudden, we just look up, and then there's other times that we just know our priorities are out of whack, and we just have not been very good at resisting. We just, not great in this area, a little bit weak in this area. The Hebrews had this biblical practice for helping them stay true to what was important and what was most crucial in their lives, because it was easy for them to forget, too. The story of the people of God is God being faithful, God's people forgetting and turning away, and God continuing to be faithful and restore over and over and over again. That is the story of our scriptures. God's people saying, I know you love us, I know you're faithful, but we kind of want to go this way, and God's saying, oh, sighing, giving in, and working with it. Each direction. Okay, it's like having a mouse that you make a maze for, and every time it jumps over the edge of the maze, over the bricks. I killed my sister's mouse when we were children because she did that, and he jumped over the bricks, and I stepped on it when I wasn't looking. So I wasn't planning on talking about that, but it's the most traumatic event of my childhood, actually. So it just came into my mind as I'm talking about this. But so you put new bricks in a new direction to try to redirect back to where we need to go. This is God's work with people, and it's been happening throughout all of history, and it happened with the Hebrews. And so what they needed to do in order to figure out how to remember these things is that they adopted this practice, and it's in Deuteronomy 6. And one of the practices was declaring. It's called the Shema, all right? The Shema is the listen. Here, the word here in Hebrew is Shema. Okay, so it was called the Shema, and what they would do is multiple times a day, they would declare this to each other and to themselves in prayer. Hear, O Israel, that the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your strength. Okay, and then Moses commands them that in order to keep this fresh, and not just this, but the laws of God, which is the way of God in the world, what they were supposed to do was two things. Not just impress them onto your children, remind them, teach them, talk about them all the way. But then he says, tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. And what that represented was, remember, when you are making choices, remember to let your minds be directed in the direction of God's hope, God's way. And let your hands reflect those choices of God's priorities, okay? So the mind and the action that follows. Hold on to that. All right, now back to Revelation. Here we go. So, faithfulness will always be hard. That is the key idea behind the book of Revelation. Faithfulness is a battle. It is difficult. It will always be that way. And it's the story of the churches at the time of John the Revelator. I don't think anyone actually calls him the Revelator. It's like, John's like declaring Jesus, I'll be back. So there's this image of John, and he's getting, and he's seeing Jesus' heart. And it's about being faithful. Jesus' churches here at the time in Asia had intense persecution. They had just gotten through the time of Nero. Nero was a brutal, brutal Roman emperor. Nero persecuted and killed Christians because he directed all worship to himself. And when he persecuted and killed Christians, he put their bodies in cages. He lit them on fire for days on end to light his gardens. Okay? So this is the church at this time. I mentioned this last week. This is a church that only two generations after Pentecost is worn out, beat up, and on the brink of extinction in their minds. John has been preaching, and because of his preaching, he has been exiled. He was not killed. We don't know why, but he was exiled to the island of Patmos. And while he is out here on this island, he receives a vision. And by this time, maybe the reason is that Nero was not alive anymore. Although there were rumors that we'll get to later. But Domitian had taken over, and Domitian wasn't quite as brutal, okay, as Nero was. And so maybe there are less deaths attributed to Domitian, the emperor, than there were to, or the Caesar, than there were to Nero. And so maybe in this time, maybe there was a lot of exile going on, and instead of killing somebody, you sent them away. But for whatever reason, John is out here. He's lost his voice among the churches, and he regains it on this island because Jesus comes and meets him in a dynamic way. And he gives him a message. And the message is to be sent back to the churches. It's a letter. It's actually called a circular letter, a letter that is meant to be circulated among a group of churches. So we can't ever understand Revelation for now unless we understand Revelation for then, because it's a letter addressed to a certain people, okay? So that's where we always need to start. And so this persecution now, it's actually less intense, and it's in the midst of this Pax Romana, this Roman peace, where Rome was so powerful, they called it peace. It wasn't real peace, because it was peace by coercion and by power and by threat of violence. And so Rome says, hey, look, we're not in war, because they were so powerful that everybody else would be killed if they tried. So therefore, look at this great peace that we have brought. Of course, it was a peace that was built completely on fear. But this is the world, okay? This is the world that is happening. And John gets this vision. All right, and so in this vision, he is given images to be passed on to God's people, and they are rooted in a time and place, but what we are going to see is that they're also completely timeless, and that's the beauty of this book. So after an introduction where Jesus is seen as the great witness, the martyr, witness is the same word, martyro, that's the Greek word for where we get martyr, is the same, it means witness. It doesn't always mean dying. It means a witness, being one who illuminates God, who reveals God, who is a witness to what God is doing and has done, okay? So Jesus is revealed as the great witness, and then right after that, what we get is we get a specific message after Jesus has been revealed as the conqueror and the true ruler of all the kings of the earth. What we get is this image or these letters, specific messages to seven churches, okay? And so the churches are represented as lampstands with the idea that the light is the light of the Spirit or the light of God. And so we have these churches here, okay? And as much as it pains me, I'm going to make a building because it's just easiest. But so there's these churches, and there's seven of them. And each time, John gives kind of a prophetic message from Jesus. And each time, Jesus evaluates them. And he says, you're going through a difficult time, but you're going to have choices. And here's where you've done well. And he goes into the classic method of the prophetic. And so if you look at the prophets in the Old Testament, they always did two things, including John, actually, John the Baptist in the New Testament. What they did was they would criticize and say where the people were going off wrong, away from the heart of God. But they would also energize, and they would say, but if you remain faithful, you will see unbelievable, beautiful things happen once again. So there was criticism and there was energizing, criticizing and energizing. These are the two things that happen. And we see it again in these churches. And over, the churches are evaluated, and some things they're doing really well, and some things they've lost their way. Sometimes they've become drunk on power, or they've started to play into the culture of the age and the idolatry. Sometimes they've become rich and self-sufficient, and they don't realize, Jesus says, that you are in poverty because you think you are rich, and you don't realize what you've lost. So in the midst of all of this, there is two choices that the churches are faced with, because the Roman Empire is now infiltrating all areas of life. And so the question is, will they compromise on one side? Will they deny Jesus, or will they be faithful? Those are the two options that the churches are given, okay? And the compromise, by the way, or the denying of Jesus would have been based on two things. Number one, it would have been based on fear of persecution. So they would compromise based on fear, but on the other side, they would compromise because the spirit of the age is very attractive. To play into the Rome was powerful. If you acquiesced, Rome loved assimilation. So they wouldn't hate you if you were a Jew as long as you became a Roman. Come and join us. Join in our way of life. Worship Caesar. Join in enjoying the fruits of our violence. And so there was fear and comfort that both could lead to compromise. Okay? And comfort, it has to do with money. Fear has to do with power. Okay? Two of the great downfalls of our world. Yes? So, this is the stage that the churches who are listening and reading are thinking about. This is not helpful, is it, for me to be sitting directly in front of a whiteboard that I'm trying to use? Let's do this. I realize that's not necessarily helping very much, is it? So, okay, so here's where we're at. And what happens is the battle between fear and comfort and compromise and faithfulness is played out over the next chapters of Revelation. Played out in vivid, vivid details. And so John sees these visions, and we're actually going to get into the stronger kind of judgments that come out of the trumpets and the seals as they're broken and the plagues, all of these things that happen. But remember, it's Hebrew apocalyptic literature, right? So everything is representative of something else, not literal in the way that we might think of it as literal. Okay, it's like a political cartoon I explained last week. There's truths being shown, but in a non-literal way. So what matters is what these things represent. So we're going to skip some of the seals this week, and we're going to go to that next week when we talk about hope a bit, and the trumpets and the bowls. And instead, we're going to take a look at the challenge of allegiance and the main characters of chapters 12 through 14, which affect us today. Now, Jess is not here, which is glorious, because then I can talk about her family, and she'll just hear about it after the fact. But so a bunch of years ago, when we were in another location, in another building, and you know we do a similar thing here. When it's Christmas Eve, we do kind of a fun Christmas Eve pageant with our kids. Bethany has directed something. It's creative and fun. And one of the things that we do is we always let the littlest kids dress up as animals and be present at the manger. And so the first year that we did this, we said, hey, just whatever you've got is great. We want to embrace it. We want to have fun. And we want to just have a good time here. So it's okay, whatever animals you are. So we've got bunny rabbits at the manger, and we've got all this. But then they're not on for most of the scene while the older kids are acting and portraying. They only come in at the end, like Oh Holy Night is singing or is playing, and you know, all these this procession of little kids dressed up as animals comes in. And at the end of this processional, I look and there's this kid, and it's Jess and Matt's kid, dressed up as a dragon. And I'm like, well, that's a bit of a loose interpretation of animals for the manger scene here. And she was like, you know, Halloween was recent. We didn't have many other options, so here you go. And I just remember looking at it and being like, you know, okay. I mean, that picture's probably not going to make our website banner ever, but we'll embrace it. But here's the thing. It was totally biblical. All right, so let's look at Revelation 12. Because this is where it starts to get fun. And so we move into the realms of dragons. Okay, so up until this point, John's been seeing all of these angels, and there's been massive chaos that evil represents that's been happening all over the world. And sometimes we think it's being unleashed by the angels, but I think the vision is more accurately portrayed as they are showing what is and maybe what is to come. But it's within the context of the reality of everyday evil that happens around us. And then the story is retold from a new perspective. And the story starts with a dragon. So all of a sudden, John looks up, and the dragon stood on the shore. Oh, that's Revelation 13. Where's Revelation 12? Oh, I'm going to have to read you Revelation 12. I'm sorry. I didn't include it there. We don't want to get before the dragons. We got to explain the dragon. So there was a great and wondrous sign that appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun. She's beautiful. With a crown, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars under her head. Come on, Hebrew students, what's 12? What's it mean? Tribes. It means the people of God, right? The 12 apostles, the 12 tribes of Israel, but it's representative of all the people of God. So we have an image here of a woman who is Israel, but it's the new Israel, so it's inclusive of everyone who is God's people. So we've got this woman who is God's people, okay, but specifically in line of the people of Israel. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns. 7 crowns, perfect power. But the dragon is representative of the serpent that we know. So not good power, the fullness of evil power. Okay, his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. That's out of Psalm 2, where we look and God will make things right by bringing one who will be the ruler over all of the nations, and he will rule with an iron scepter. So it's a reference to the Psalm. Remember, 400-some verses in Revelation, 512 Old Testament references in Revelation. something like that. Listen to what I said last week. Those are the numbers. They're close. And so here's what we have. She gave birth to a son, and her child was snatched up to God and his throne. So before the dragon can devour the child is swept away by God and protected. And then there's a battle that ensues between the dragon and between God, and the dragon is chasing after the woman, but every time the dragon chases after the woman, he gets close, but he can never quite catch her. She's always just out of grasp. It's meant to tell us about God's continued work with the people of Israel, even though they continued to be tempted and had to battle evil on all sides, sometimes from outside of them, sometimes from within them, but that God's faithfulness continued to keep them away, and the dragon never, ever wins, even though he chases. Okay, so that's the story here. And then eventually the dragon is flown down to earth. It says, the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. That's exactly 3.5 years. This is just conjecture that appears 3 or 4 times throughout the Bible. I'm imagining that what that was is that is the time, and it looks like a time of peace or a time of safety. We're imagining that's probably the amount of time that Domitian had been in power since Nero left. And so John's giving an image to his people of the fact that they're in a season where they feel at least moderately protected, but it's only a season. And there will be further pain coming. He tried to fight, but he was not strong enough. And they lost, and he lost his place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent. So this is where they just are explicit. That ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, the Satan, who leads the world astray. He was hurled down to the earth and his angels with him. All right, and then a couple verses later, I heard a loud voice from heaven say, now have come the salvation and the power of the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. So what are they doing battle with? Again, they're doing battle with the self-sacrificial nature of God giving himself in the atonement, but it's more than that. It's the word of their testimony, their lives. They did not so much love their lives as to shrink from death. This is a part of the battle. This is a part of how they win, by dying. It's all through Revelation. Therefore, you heavens, rejoice, and you who dwell in them. So when the dragon sees that he's been hurled down to earth, he continues to chase the woman. He does not catch her, but in verse 17 of chapter 12, then the dragon, enraged at the woman, went off to make war against the rest of her offspring. We are getting a picture of the reality of earth, okay? This is the battle between good and evil. And those make war against the rest of her offspring and those who obey God's commands and hold the testimony of Jesus. Okay, so we are seeing in vivid detail, John is saying, we understand, God understands that you feel like there is this battle that you are being chased, but don't worry, don't worry. The dragon won't overcome. And so we have this spiritual reality that starts. But in addition to the spiritual reality, all of a sudden, we get to chapter 13. And so we've been told about the past, and now we move into the present. And this is where it gets really, really fascinating. And this is where I think we can catch up. Yeah. So the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. It's this image of kind of waiting and being a little bit powerless. And I saw a beast. Here we go. You know we're talking about beasts today, right? Okay, so there's two beasts that come in Revelation 13. All right, and I saw a beast come out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads with 7 crowns on its horns, or with 10 crowns. And on each had a blasphemous name, meaning a name that denied the divinity and the power of God. That's what blasphemy means. It means idolatry. It means that somebody is bringing power to themselves that does not belong to them. Okay, the beast I saw resembled a leopard, but it had feet like a bear and a mouth like a lion. Okay, now this is just fantastic imagery, but that's all we think if we're not kind of versed in Jewish understanding and theology. Because guess what? The image of a leopard, a beast that looked like a leopard, but also like a bear and also like a lion, is not the first time that it's appearing in the Bible, okay? What we see here is that in Daniel 7, Daniel has a vision about the nations that are in rebellion against God. And in my vision, I looked and there were 4 winds of heaven churning up, yada, yada, yada. The first was like a lion, the beast. And the second beast was like a bear. And the third beast was like a leopard. Okay, so what that represented, it represented Babylon, And then the nation that conquered Babylon and became the new Babylon, which was Assyria, and then Persia came after that. And then there's a fourth beast that represented Greece with Alexander the Great's brutal leadership. By this time, the Romans in Jewish theology had replaced the idea of Greece. And so they read Daniel, and they read the fourth beast, and they called it Rome. Okay? So what we're understanding is there were these beasts that represented these powerful nations. But in John's view, then, what happens is he sees one beast that represents them all. This is really crucial because it's not intended to be one thing. It's intended to be a characterization of the beastly power of nations that were using their power to oppress. Okay, so this first beast is like, you know, really scary. I hope that's scary enough for you. And so the first beast comes from the land, and it represents power and might. Let's read a little bit more about him. What he does, it says, this is really interesting. This is really interesting. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. Okay, so at first we think, is that like a Jesus reference? Like, been killed but was healed. But here's the thing that happened. At this time, even though Nero had died, there were rumors of two things because of Nero's claim of divinity. Number one, he hadn't actually died, and he was just lying in waiting to come back and persecute. But the second rumor is that he had died, and he was going to rise again and persecute the Christians. So Christians were still terrified of Nero. So we get this image of this dragon, or of this beast, I mean, and the beast looks like all of the nations of the past and the present, and even a special little tick off of the idea of the one that they're the most afraid of is present in this. So see it, John is saying, or Jesus is saying to the people that John is writing to. And what the beast does is everybody in the world follows this beast. Men worship the dragon because it had given authority to the beast, but they also worship the beast. And here's the question they asked. Who is like the beast who could make war against him? He's too powerful. He will crush everybody. The beast uttered proud words and blasphemies and on and on and on. And then the end of the section, verse 10, John writes in the Revelation, this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. So he says, listen, let's just lay this out clear. I'm saying these things, and of what is going on, what has happened, what will happen, and it requires faithful perseverance and patient endurance. You have to stick along the path because you are going to see powers take things that are not belonging to them and treat them like they are their own gods. And so then we get another beast. All right. Okay. And this beast comes out of the sea. Okay. All right, and so what we get is the second beast, and this is in Revelation 13, verse 11, and we're going somewhere with this. Then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth. It had horns like a lamb. It's a fake Jesus, okay? It's almost a caricature. It's almost a poking fun. It had, but it spoke like a dragon, so people could see through it. People could see through it, but at first, it was much more palatable than the first beast, much more comfortable. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it made the earth worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to the earth in full view of the people. So in other words, signs that made people say, this is the greatest power. And what they did was, because of the signs, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. So it gave power, it gave its authority to the original beast. The second beast was given power to give breath to the image of the first so the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. Okay, so it's really important to know that what these are working together for at the end is blood. That the end of this power is to be understood as eventually, even though people are giving their allegiance to these beasts, they will eventually call for your very life, okay? And so we're intended to start to understand what's happening in this story as both the militant power of the nation to control and instill fear and kill, and the engine which points people to worship and honor that above all else. Specifically, as we'll see in a few verses, the economic engine. And so, so this beast does amazing signs to impress people, but it eventually, like everything else, it demands absolute allegiance or death, and those who refuse to worship the beast will be expelled and killed. Okay, so now verses 16 to 18. This is really important about the second beast. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or their foreheads, so they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. That number is 666. Okay, let's divide this into two parts real quick. What do you see in the first part? What do you see? They had to have a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark. Deuteronomy, this is the anti-Shema. Okay, so what is trying to be convinced or conveyed here is that what's happening in the world is that people's minds, their way of thinking, and their actions, their way of doing things, have become more synonymous with the powers of the world than with the risen king, who is the Lamb. Okay? This is intended to be not taken in any of the ridiculous left-behind ways that we've done. It's instead intended to be understood as there will be a constant temptation for the way that we think and for the work of our hands to express the values of the world around us, specifically the world that will oppress and that will use power, comfort, money, all as its own gods, over and above the calling of the people of God, which is to keep my word against your head and on your wrists, and to tell your children, and to remain faithful. Do we understand what's going on? Does that make sense? Most scholars, well, we'll get to that. But let's do the second thing. So this calls for wisdom. And this is really interesting, because with everything that's been done with the number 666 in our world, it's nuts, because this is actually maybe the most blatant, obvious one. This is not rocket science. Sorry, Tyler. In any way, this is like super easy stuff. So what happens is, how much more obvious can John get? This calls for wisdom, people. Think about it. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. We're like, what does that mean? Well, there's something called gematria. It's where we get our word geometry. And what it means is that in both Greek and Hebrew language, every word and letter has a numeric value with it. This is just the way the language is written. Gematria, if you want to research it. So many languages have a gematria, or you can call it numerology, but that sometimes gets into the spiritual world, and this has nothing to do with that. But it's got values. So what you're saying is, he says, it's the number of a man. This beast, this one who requires worship that is not due to him. And guess what? The word beast, if you put the gematria on it and look through that lens, is 666. Also 666, Nero Caesar. So what we're saying is, he's giving a tip of the hat and saying, listen, this power over you that you are terrified of, This is him. It's Nero, but it's not just him. It's all of his ilk. It's all who fall in this way of doing things. But the really fascinating thing is that with all of that, this is written in Greek, but it's written to Hebrew people. So Romans, they know Greek, but they don't know Hebrew. So it's code language, because you would read it in Greek and it wouldn't make that much sense. But about this time, some would still be fully aware of all of the gematria of the Hebrew people, and others would have to go to their rabbi because it was starting to fall out of practice. So when he says, let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, he's giving code language so the Romans can read this and don't understand how much of a threat this is. They don't understand that John's revelation is saying to all the people, hey, guess what? This guy who you are terrified of, and maybe rightly so sometimes, but who acts like he rules the world, he's just a beast and he is going down. He can never compete with the slain lamb. His power is temporary, as we'll see in a moment. So that's the beauty of something like this. So Nero Caesar is not the only one, but he's one of them. One of the ones who draws power to himself that represents this empire that uses power and economics to oppress and control. And so we have over here, we have the temptation to follow the beast, and that's about power. But we also have over here the temptation to follow the beast that's about comfort and money and using money to lull us into this sense where we don't even realize that we're beginning to worship something other than God. We can worship our nation because we have a good living and we have enough money, and all of a sudden we begin to idolatrize our own country and give it value and meaning that is almost beyond God in our lives. It happens. We see it. We need to be aware of this. It can do so much damage. So the first beast is the violent power of Babylon. The second one is the economic machine, the comfort and money of how it pushes us to trust something other than Jesus. It's kind of summed up in Psalm 20, 7 and 8. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. That was chariots and horses meant some trust in the power of military might to rescue all the time, but not us. We trust in the name of the Lord our God, the name of God with us, the name of Yahweh, the name eventually of Emmanuel, of the fallen and slain Lamb who is above all. So rather than this being a massive retelling of, you know, like Fantastic Beasts, the sequel or something, this whole section is a critique of empire. And it's a warning of the power of three things: political domination and militarism. It's a warning of religion, where the political order is identified with the divine. I am God's chosen. It is also a critique of the economic networks of human exploitation. Okay? And so this is the beasts, and these are the beastly things that happen when we let something that God designed for good, for meaningful purpose, to get out of hand and bring power and honor to themselves in a way that they never, ever should have been brought. And so these things, they become gods and they command our worship unless we resist. And guess what? We do. We do resist. Chapter 14. Here we go. Then I looked. This is right after the second beast. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb. So all of a sudden we see these beasts, but then here's the resistance. The Lamb standing, and with him 144,000, that is 12 tribes of 12,000 of Israel, which represents the fullness of all of God's people through all of history, who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Ah, it's such great imagery. We will not live the lie of worshiping money, of worshiping power as the means of changing the world. We will be people of the Lamb. And what are they doing? There's this sound from heaven. This is really fascinating. I don't have a solution for this one. From heaven, like the roar of rushing waters and a loud peal of thunder. Powerful. But the sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps. Powerful, and yet harps. Beautiful. Subtle. Gentle, even. Like, how many have ever, like, heard, like, a killer riff on a harp? Like, Adam, you would be the one, if anyone has. But, like, you just don't do that. You know, I play the electric harp. You know, like, no one, like, really, like, it just doesn't happen. So there's this dichotomy there, too. It's powerful by thunder, but it sounds beautiful. And they're singing. They're singing. They're doing battle by singing before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. Remember, we looked at that last week. That means all of the created world, these creatures with eyes everywhere. All eyes are on him, the elders, the apostles, and the 12 tribes, all together, and the people that they represent. They had been redeemed. And then it talks a little bit strange language. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they remained virgins. That's a super contextual phrase. It's not talking about anything literal. It's talking about how the purity of their appearance looked. In complete purity. And what the purity looks like is that they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. This is the representation of the resistance. They follow the Lamb. They don't ever adopt the tactics of the beasts. They follow the Lamb. But boy, it's tempting. And it's beautiful, though. The allure of Babylon in our lives may be strong. And it is strong. And it can scare us to be an alternative of kind of absolute allegiance when God's allegiance is the only thing that is deserving. It may be comfortable to enjoy our money. It might be comfortable to live where we do and maybe ignore those in need around us. It might be easy to think that our hope is the systems of the world rather than God's kingdom. Are you familiar with the Babylon Bee? Okay, so the Babylon Bee, if you're not, you know The Onion, right? Satire news site. It's all joking. It's not serious. So every now and then the Babylon Bee, it's a Christian version of that, and it just comes out with something that's just so good. And this week, this was the article that the Babylon Bee came out. Local Christian, counting on the kingdom of God as a backup plan, just in case his favorite political party fails him. And boy, folks, don't laugh it off too quick. The article said, quoting him, and remember, this is all just satire, "On the off chance that my political party doesn't usher in peace on earth, I guess there's always Jesus," he thoughtfully said as he opened his Bible for morning devotions but spent most of the time checking the Twitter feeds of his favorite political pundits to see which front of the culture war would be fought today. It's good to have a plan B to fall back on. Tenney said, however, that he doesn't expect his chosen political party to fail him. He pointed out that they have money, power, and the promise to use government to do all of the stuff that he approves of. It's got a beastly nature to it if we're not careful, friends. New Testament scholar Bruce Metzger says, "Babylon is allegorical of the idolatry that any nation commits when it elevates material abundance, military prowess, technological sophistication, imperial grandeur, racial pride, and any other glorification of the creature over the creator. The message of the book of Revelation concerns God's judgments, not only of persons, but also nations, and in fact, all authorities, corporations, institutions, structures, bureaucracies, and the like, even Christian churches." Our churches can even fall prey to using power as a means of changing things, intimidating people, pulling your authority card, "I'm the pastor." I don't know if I've done that. I sure hope not. We try hard to not be people who use power over, but rather power under. But it can infiltrate. These temptations of the way the world works can infiltrate us from any level. So faithfulness will look like resistance. And so what might resistance look like? And here's where we'll end, by just throwing these final ideas together. What does faithfulness look like in the book of Revelation? Faithfulness looks like naming false peace. Is it Jeremiah that says, "Peace, peace, you cry when there is no peace, because there is oppression, because there is violence, just not in front of you." And so we have to learn how, like we were told and see in the book of Revelation, when there are times where it doesn't seem like there's conflict, but we know that the reason that there isn't is because people are being mistreated, we have to name that. We have to give voice to that. If we just shut people up by intimidation and then call it peace, it's not. If we threaten people and then say, "See, isn't it great that we're at peace," and we're not, we need to speak that. That is a part of the prophetic role of Christians. So we need to name false peace when we see it. We need to pray. How radical does that sound? But guess what? In the book of Revelation, there's this chapter. In chapter 8, there's this story. And it's right after the scroll is opened and the final seal is broken. And there's silence over the whole land for 30 minutes. And it's really weird. It's the only time there's silence. And it's as if the silence is God listening to the prayers of the people. And an angel takes it and he stirs it with the Spirit and they toss it back to earth. And when the prayers of the people hit earth, Eugene Peterson calls it reversed thunder. It explodes. It shakes the earth. Prayer is what shakes the earth for the army of the Lamb. I think sometimes we either have the tendency on one side to overpromise with prayer and act like whatever we want, as long as we plug in the right ATM code, we get it. And God becomes kind of our ATM machine. But on the other side, to think that prayer isn't powerful, and we talk about contemplative spirituality all the time, but we can think that the only value in prayer is just being with Jesus, that there's no power in it, but it's nice to grow closer to Jesus. That's not the story of the scripture. It's a both and. Prayer is powerful, but it's also mysterious, but it shakes the earth. So we have to learn how to pray. Pray for those who are experiencing persecution. Pray for those who are overlooked and forgotten. Pray for protection against the temptations to be just like the world in every way. Okay. We also have to choose to reject violence and power as a means of change. I've mentioned this so many times over the last 2 weeks, but the way of the Lamb is being willing to suffer if that's what it takes to bring about change, not to force other people to suffer. And so we reject the world that says that violence is the way, that power, that intimidation is the way. We also reject comfort when it is about loving and trusting in our money and our resources for security. We choose to reject that way of thinking. And this is super hard, friends, because don't we all feel better when our job pays a little bit more? Don't we all feel better when we're not worried about our finances? We are. And there's blessing and there's beauty in some of that, unless it becomes where we trust. Unless we say, my future will be made or broken based on money. That is not the story of God. Some of the richest people on earth are the most spiritually depraved, and some of the poorest people on earth are the most spiritually rich. And we know this. It's just hard to remind ourselves. We've seen it. We've seen the emptiness of loving money more than God. And it's the only thing, by the way, that Jesus talks about as having equal pull as God. He's the only thing that in the Gospels, Jesus compares money and God to each other. Suffering faithfully. I mentioned that with rejected violence, but it's the choice to say, I will choose to continue to love and continue to be faithful to Jesus, even if it ostracizes me. That doesn't mean being a jerk for Jesus, right? We've talked about this. We Christians in the U.S., we wave the persecution flag all the time. But we need to not do that, but we need to understand that when we live differently, sometimes it will ostracize us. When we love radically, sometimes it'll put us on the outside of any political party or on the outside of certain conversations or assumptions or on the outside of a number of things when we respect the value of every single person, even when it costs us our reputation. And worship, finally. Worship is how faithfulness looks in Revelation. We give glory to the Lamb of God, not to the things around us. We remind ourselves by singing together, by praying together, by setting our mind on the way of Jesus. That's how we choose over and over and over again that the oppressive powers of the world will not be the thing that captures my heart, that anger will not be the thing that captures my heart most primarily, that selfishness and greed, that even my country will not be the thing that captures my heart and demands my allegiance more than my allegiance to the kingdom of God, which stretches into every nation on earth. All right, let's pray. God, help us sort through the stuff. We worked through some serious things in these last moments. I pray that the things that we need to hear would be heard, that other things would fall away, but that you would continue to draw us into your love and help us be faithful when allegiance is at stake and when the battles rage in us and around us and in our world. Help us look like the Lamb. Amen.